This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
But when does protesting for a cause morph from free expression and become a terrorist act? Well, that notion comes to the fore in Mark Smith's latest novel, Where Truth Ends. So, Mark, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's start with Luke Marr. He has a lovely job, which you can tell us about, a lovely bucolic setting where he works, but he's got a range of challenges that he faces. So who is he? What is he? What are his challenges?
He has. Luke Marr is the riverkeeper on the Birrarung, on the Yarra River, and he has, as you say, a number of challenges. He patrols the river most days, and he's looking for any spillage into the river, anything coming through the drains, you know, the litter build up, that sort of thing. But in actual fact, his job does sound quite big. There is a real person, you know, called the riverkeeper on the Birrarung, and it was a job that was done by a friend of mine, Charlotte Sterrett, who, when I was researching this book, took me out onto the river on her little solar-powered boat, and we went up and down the river. So looking at the floating wetlands that they've established and, as I said, the outfalls into the river, making sure that nothing's coming down there that shouldn't be. But on top of that, Luke has lots of problems because he has to maintain his position, and that means negotiating with his employers, with the government, getting funds, grants, submissions, all of those things that occupy way too much of his time.
And basically, he's compromised because there's not the political will, there's not the economic backing to do what is necessary. So why not protest? We've had environmental protesters out there. Married to Kirsty, she's got a range of challenges as well. Yeah.
Kirsty is a teacher in a Western suburb school with a high enrolment of really diverse ethnic groups, and which she loves working with, but she also finds difficult. And she said she loves them and hates them in equal measure.
But there's the support for teachers is wanting as well. Yeah. There's a political announcement for you,
as we've seen on the streets in the last couple of weeks in Victoria, and the rejection of the wage offer that's been made by the Victorian government.
But the problems are similar. Not enough money to protect the environment, not enough money for the schools, the political will to make it happen. We have to resort to protest. But just before we get onto that protest, this is now set in Melbourne, and that adds a sort of extra dimension, I think, in terms of the intensity we feel later on.
It does, and it was very close to home for me. You asked us as we came on air, what was the last protest you went to? The last big one that I went to was the pro-Palestinian one about the visit of the Israeli president to Australia, and it was right at the intersection of Flinders Street and Swanson Street, which was completely packed, completely jammed all the way up Swanson Street and along Flinders Street as well. And that just so happens to be the pivotal point where my book begins.
Yes.
So I was sort of hoping, as I was sitting there on the steps of the cathedral looking out over this mass, thinking, I hope that life does not imitate art here, because something very dramatic happens at that intersection.
And we'll get on to that. Yeah. But it has become a pivot point, the Flinders Street intersection, the guy in the car that then
went down people. Burke Street,
It's been blocked several times. Mm. It's a pivot point of Melbourne.
It is.
Really. Yeah. Now we get to Meg, and Meg is the daughter of Luke and Kirsty, and she's been a little more proactive in her conduct. What has she been doing, and how does it lead to Flinders Street intersection?
So Meg is a millennial, and she is one of those people, and I don't think this is unusual, who's lost faith in institutions and institutions' ability to actually enact change. She's very concerned about climate. So what she does is she joins a clandestine climate group called No Planet B. And this is a very secretive organisation which has no office, no footprint, no nothing. And even the members of the group are unknown to each other. So when they take part in an action, they're all disguised. They all wear hazmat suits, goggles, masks, and they do not even know who their fellow protesters are.
They have pseudonyms. Yeah,
they all have pseudonyms.
Yes.
So that's where Meg becomes involved in that very first action, which takes place at, we've talked about, at the intersection of Flinders Street and Swanson Street, peak hour on a Tuesday morning, and
they block it. Delay what's about to come, because there's a precedent for this sort of conduct. You mentioned Extinction Rebellion. These people are taking a more aggressive approach.
They are, and I think it's indicative of the frustration that a lot of people feel, not just millennials, but people, myself as well, frustration at the lack of action that. That in particular governments and authorities are taking. And I don't think it's unusual to lose that faith in institutions and to look for, okay, what needs to be done here? And how dramatic and how drastic does our action need to be? And what are the limits of that action? And are those limits real or not?
So there is a truck that they're on. They park it in the centre of that Flinders Street intersection. Yeah. What happens now?
So the in the back of the truck are six activists, Meg being one of them, all disguised from each other, so they don't know who the others are. And at a certain point, they open out the back of the truck, they jump out, they've got flares, they've got banners, they're chanting, they're blocking traffic, there are police everywhere, there are sirens going. After they do this for about 15, 20 minutes, and at a designated signal, they all disperse, they shoot off. They head off in different directions into the city, and they go underground, and they do anything. They go to their designated points to strip off their
away from CCTV,
and then they meld back into the community. So, but what happens is that half an hour after the demonstration is finished, the truck is still there. The truck explodes.
Oh.
There's a bomb in the truck.
Now this brings up a very intriguing question. Given that these are clandestine groups, how susceptible are they to being influenced by external parties? Because Meg is not an activist in that regard. If she'd known a bomb was involved, she wouldn't have done it.
No.
But how susceptible are they?
I think every organisation is susceptible to infiltration in that way, because you think about it, and I've been a protest organiser, rally organiser. You have no control over who turns up. So what happens if, you know, in your peaceful rally, a group of neo-Nazis turn up? You can't stop them from showing up to the rally. I've been in organisations that have been infiltrated from the beginning, from the planning stages, by people from the media, from the right-wing media, and other organisations. So you're very vulnerable. All of those organisations are vulnerable to that.
Political infiltration?
Political infiltration. There was one in particular that I was part of, where we couldn't figure out how the police and authorities seemed to be one step ahead of us all the way. They seemed to know where we were going to be, what we were going to be doing, and it wasn't until that was beginning to happen two or three times in a row that we realised, oh, hang on, we've got a leak here. And that leak was someone who had been supposedly part of the organising committee right back at the inception of the group.
But even it goes even further. When you look at, there are countries that are basically generating terrorism on the dark web by paying individuals who've got no connection culturally or politically and giving them a fee, go and commit an act of arson.
That's right, yep.
So protest groups are very vulnerable in that regard.
Yeah, and that's the situation that Meg finds herself in. She is completely innocent. She has no idea about this, you know, about there being a bomb in the truck, but suddenly she's on the run, and she's not just being hunted as an activist, she's being hunted as a terrorist. And this is a, you know, mid-20s, uni student, great family, you know, mum, dad, and it's to back to her family that she goes to try and find refuge, which means, of course, that she implicates them, because she can't help but tell them what has happened. So hence we raise, and I love toying in writing with moral dilemmas. So the moral dilemma here is, what would you do if your child came to you with that information and you knew that if you handed them in, you were not going to see them again for, you know, maybe years.
And what is a parent's instinctive response? What would you do, Jan?
For you? It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd go to jail, Jan. This is the dilemma that Mark raises. But there's another interesting little connection with Meg here, because her now ex-boyfriend, they've just broken up, Adam, has political connections and yet he comes under suspicion.
Yeah. Adam is a low-level staffer in the Premier's office. So he's privy to information that's not making its way to the media. So even though Meg's in a conflicted situation because she's actually broken up with this with Adam, but she needs the information that he can provide. So again,
but he's also tracking, following her, wanting to know.
There's been a certain amount of coercive control that's been happening in this relationship, and that's why Meg has been determined to leave it. So it's another one of those levels that books can work on. You know, I love that idea of them being complex in that way, that there are a number of different streams which eventually, of course, come together.
Well, a number of things that ways that it could be interpreted.
Yes.
What is his interest there, etc. But it's a very current topical issue as well. But then you raise the tension even further, if the bomb's not enough, because all of a sudden we have the perpetrators of this bomb trying to cover their tracks. And this is where the novel swings into a thriller, because there are a number of those that were involved who are now deceased.
Mm.
So we're left with a question, was that deliberate or accidental, coincidental? What happens to Meg in this regard?
Yeah, so Meg realises everything in this novel happens in 5 days. So everything is very quick. It's happening in real time. And she realises at some stage that she's being followed. And she doesn't know who these people are, but she knows, she suspects there's some connection to the protest. So, yes, she is under threat. And then she has the moral dilemma about, does she tell her parents about that as well? Or does she keep that to herself? Does she tell her ex-boyfriend? And
would they be threatened if that was, if she did reveal it?
Possibly.
And the novel culminates in the Otways. You take us to the Otways. Why is that? Because I think there's a reason.
That's my stomping ground. That's my home area. The Otways has somehow appeared in a number of my books. It's just an area that I've worked in for really about 30 years or so. Worked and walked and surfed and climbed, and so I know the area intimately. I love that idea of you know, being very, very familiar with the landscape myself and bringing that into the
writing.
But
the denseness of the landscape, it's also raining, it's at night, so it becomes very claustrophobic.
It
almost
does. And I mean, this book is morphing itself into a thriller, so you know, in a book like this, if you think it's going to happen over 5 days, you know you're not going to get some sort of, you know, complete resolution in 5 days with all of these issues. So, I spoke recently on a panel with Bree Lee, who's written a book called Seed, which is also a climate change thriller, and she used the term that I really like. It she says the thriller is just the Trojan horse, you know, for the things that you really want to talk about, and that. I sort of adopted that idea for where truth ends as well.
And a lot of those ideas come out in the novel. So there's a moral dimension to Mark Smith's novel, Where Truth Ends, which is actually very immediate given the challenges we all face in the modern world. So it's not just Meg's life that's in danger, but the whole notion of truth. And it's a Pan Macmillan release. So, Mark, thank you very much for talking with me
today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, Sarah Clutton has woven together a family saga, a Celtic mythology, unmarried mothers, and a love of antiquarian books in her The Bookshop of Buried Pasts. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Dorothea's grandmother had taught her about herbs and also about the Morrigan, goddess of death and fate, who was a shapeshifter appearing as a raven or a crow. Dorothea has her own special knowing. What's her ability?
Oh, well, Dorothea is very intuitive, but more so than most people. Her knowing extends to knowing things that she couldn't really possibly know. For example, she knows when a woman is pregnant before the woman herself knows. So she's one of these people who live at the edge of rationality, and she's very tapped into her intuition and her herbalism.
Well, the book starts when Dorothea is 19 years old. She's working and learning in the bookshop, something she really enjoys, especially the rare book cabinet with precious books, the font, the hand-tooled leather bindings and gilt edges of the pages. And due to her special ability, what does she know about herself?
She knows that she is pregnant as an unmarried young woman in the 1960s, that this is not really acceptable or a good outcome for anyone. So that sort of begins the sort of starting point at which we meet Dorothea, who is in a pickle, you might say, and things unroll in, and it becomes very rollicking mystery towards what happens next.
She has made a friend of a much different social classed woman, Adeline Fitzhenry, who comes into the bookshop.
Mm. Oh, Adeline is, she's Lady Fitzhenry. She's married to Edward, not a nice person, but he does not like her habit of book collecting or her passion for book collecting, and book collectors can be very strange people. I once ghostwrote the memoir of an antiquarian book dealer, and so I got to listen to 60 years worth of stories about book collectors and the strange things they'll do, sometimes to hide their need to collect because it can get so out of hand. And so Adeline is one of those people, but she is also in a relationship of coercive control at that and not in a good marriage, so that impacts her. Yeah,
there's one thing her husband really wants. And what's that?
A son. He very much wants a son, and Adeline has not been able to give him one.
We're going to leave the angst and betrayal and swap countries, years and lives, and meet Phillida Banks. She also owns a bookshop. Where's she?
She's based in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales in a small village of Brookbank, which is based pretty much on the village in which I live, Berrima. It's a beautiful Georgian village littered with sandstone buildings and beautiful gardens and bookshops, both in real life and in the book. I call it Brookbank in here because I've added a few fictional flourishes. But she lives in this tiny village and she runs the local antiquarian bookshop, and she is beloved by everybody.
Well, she came here as a single mum. Mm. So what happened to son David?
In the 90s, her 20-year-old son David passed away from cancer, and she never, she didn't deal with that very well at the time. And so we do go back in time and meet David, and we meet Miriam, the love of his life, who gives them Lottie, one of the other protagonists in this book, Phillida's granddaughter. Yeah.
So we're now 30 years later, and granddaughter Lottie has broken up with her boyfriend Hugo and returned to work at Phillida's bookshop. 30-year-old Lottie, what does she think about her mother and her life here?
Well, she doesn't have she has a very spiky relationship with her mother. Miriam was an ex-model, and she's not a very developed sort of person. She's quite self-obsessed, and Lottie has to live with her because she's returned to her hometown, but she finds it very hard, and she's really raging against her mother and all of the crazy things her mother does.
Sarah Clutton's going to read from The Bookshop of Buried Past.
I think about my recent imaginings about finding long-lost family members and discovering they are not all self-obsessed, attention-seeking egomaniacs like my mother. I wonder if my DNA test will show I have Nordic heritage. I sent the test away 6 weeks ago and am impatiently waiting the results. I never met David, the man who was in Miriam's life for only a few months and left her pregnant with me, but I'm dying to find out any family connections he might have. I have him to thank for my excellent grandmother, Phillida. She's been a rock my whole life, although I haven't mentioned the DNA test to Phillida because I have a feeling she might not want me digging around. She's always been vague about David's father. She never talked about being married or ever having a partner, so it's a bit of an unspoken mystery.
We're going to hear from Lottie again, and this is a lovely bit.
Oh, this is after Lottie wakes up after something terrible happens. Some people get through life guided by personal rules. Eat dessert first, apply deodorant after undies, no sex before the third date, that kind of thing. I've never really seen the point in articulating a personal code, but if I had, it would probably be summarised as something like, avoid hospitals, avoid pregnancy, avoid Miriam.
Miriam's the mother. So what does mother-in-law Phyllida think of Miriam?
Oh, Phyllida and Miriam have a strained relationship despite Phyllida's efforts to keep it open and friendly, because Miriam very much resents Phyllida and her ease with which she has the relationship with Lottie and with everyone in the village, because Phyllida is such a curious and loved person.
As a beautiful skeleton preserved in alcohol.
Yeah, Miriam doesn't eat much, so Lottie's always finds her a difficult person to live with.
Phyllida, she's surrounded by good friends in this little country village. Mary next door for the last 50 years. Mary's nephew, Roddy, who was also best friends of David's. He's a single, childless, middle-aged man who solves others' financial problems, managing high net worth portfolios, which he can do anywhere. So he's come back to Brookbank. And he's always helping people. He's helping out Donna, another old school friend.
Yeah, and he suddenly landed with the care of Donna's almost 14-year-old daughter, Sienna, who is a fun character to write. She's very spiky.
She was fun to read. So she's 14-year-old with a mouth. And Roddy gets her a job working in the bookshop too. Mm. He wants her so far out, he's actually happy to pay for her to work at the bookshop.
Yeah, no, he would do anything to help her. He's got such a good heart, but he finds her so confronting, because the young can be very confronting to those who haven't had children and to those who have. In fact, living with teenagers can be a challenge. As a mother,
sure
I can tell you that.
But reading Sienna, you just knew you're going to laugh at some of the things she said and some of the requests she had. Phyllida has sorted her things and written a final letter. Now, over the years, she had always written down her guilt and despair in letters. She didn't post them, but that was hardly the point. She kept them as touchstones of her heart. Nice. And there's a crow, a Murrigan, that supports Phyllida in her next big decision. What does the letter say?
Well, the letter asks Lottie to find somebody called Francis and to tell Francis that she's always loved him, that she's sorry she left him, and that she only stayed away because she felt there was no choice. So Lottie, her granddaughter, when Phyllida sees a crow, a Murrigan, it's sort of Celtic sign, she feels it's the message that it's the time for her death, it's the time for her passing, and it's the time for her to take action. And so she leaves this letter for Lottie because she knows there are strands left unwoven into her history and she needs Lottie to go and find them and to sort them out. So
Francis, we know of him back in the 1960s.
Yes.
Growing up in Bledsley House.
Yes.
Was it a happy home he grew up in?
No, Francis grew up in Cambridgeshire in this large house, Adeline's son. And he was very unhappy. His father was a bit of a monster. And his mother died when he was young. And he grew up with a loving nanny and with a very distant father. And so we meet him early in the book as a young 10-year-old. And then we meet him again very early in the book as a man about to turn 60.
And he's had an interesting career. Costume designer?
Yes, costume designer on the West End. He's a fashion designer.
He's redecorated the stable, so Bledsley House is open to visitors.
Yes.
And he has faith that he will meet the love of his life. Yeah. But where? Not at dinner parties or polo.
No, he can't. He's a very big introvert, our Francis. But I'm pleased to say by the end of the book, he does find love. And by the end of the book, Lottie has discovered why she needed to find Francis, and that's the mystery of the book.
We get some more delights from Sienna in brusque language, demanding, give me a Roddy's credit card for him to subscribe through the paywall to the London Standard newspaper to find Francis.
Yes, yes. No, teenagers are very demanding when it comes to credit cards, in my experience.
And then she finds a podcast called Murder in the Manor.
Yeah, she does. And so that way, through Sienna's sort of ability to sleuth online, they do find Francis in the end, and they do discover what the mystery Phyllida has left behind is all those years ago.
There is a prologue and an epilogue, which makes bookends of this book, written by a most interesting choice of a narrator.
Yes. So my publisher thought I really needed to rewrite both beginning and ending, and it occurred to me when I was doing that, that perhaps the best way to do that would be the all-knowing voice of the bookshop. So the bookshop in Cambridgeshire actually narrates the opening and the closing, because it does, has seen, it is timeless and ageless and knows all of the characters in the book. So we do get to meet the bookshop.
Most intriguing. Most intriguing. It worked well with me. There are two bookshops in different countries and at different time frames, connected by more than just their names. In the bookshop of buried pasts, Sarah Clutton has woven together a family saga, Celtic mythology, unmarried mothers, and a love of antiquarian books. I think you do like bookshops, don't you?
I certainly like bookshops, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. No.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.